It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Meadowcroft Rock Shelter is considered by many to be the site of the earliest known evidence of human presence in North America, with people camping, living there as early as 19,000 years ago. Recent sediment samples from the site were collected to be tested for human DNA. James Adovasio is the director of archaeology at the Meadowcroft Rock Shelter and Historic Village. Welcome to the Confluence, sir.
Well, thank you.
James, the story of how you were drawn to this site, I find it to be a fascinating one. A farmer stumbled over a groundhog hole and uncovered what appeared to be a prehistoric tool. So how did you get involved?
Essentially, when I joined the University of Pittsburgh faculty in 1972, there was a desire to resurrect the temporarily defunct archaeological research program in western Pennsylvania. And a now-deceased historian at California, what was then California State College, now California State University, who had been a friend of the farmer who discovered Meadowcroft Rock Shelter, called me and told me about the site. And so I visited it in the spring of 1973 and almost immediately solicited permission from the Meadowcroft Foundation to begin work there in that summer.
You've been studying, exploring the site in Washington County over the last four plus decades. Was it a gradual awareness or was it a sudden instant when you said, this could be very important, this could be very old?
None of us on the staff of the excavation anticipated that it would be very old or that the deposits would be particularly deep. As it turned out, we were seriously in error, and we did not realize fully how old and how deep the deposits were until 1974, when we began to explore the depths of the site and also to get our first radiocarbon determinations back from various laboratories.
Would you describe the physical space for us? What's it look like?
Meadowcroft is essentially, like all rock shelters, is a ledge, in this case of sandstone, that protrudes over a relatively flat potential living space. Within the confines of the modern overhang, there are about 75 square meters of protected floor space upon which it never rains or snows. And the rock shelter sits on the north bank of Cross Creek, which is a third-order tributary of the Ohio River. Any human populations moving up or down Cross Creek from the Ohio River or to the Ohio River would have passed by Meadowcroft, and because it would have represented more or less a late-afternoon prehistoric Holiday Inn-type setting, they would have stopped there, and they did stop there for varying periods of time, off and on for thousands of years.
So it wasn't necessarily a permanent settlement, it was more transient?
Oh, certainly. Essentially, five or six people that knew about the local resources could exhaust the immediate vicinity of Meadowcroft of plants and animals fairly quickly. And consequently, it was always used as a locus for temporary residence and collecting of materials that may later in time have been taken back to settled villages or to other communities elsewhere in the drainage.
How can you tell that it was used temporarily time and time again? What points to that?
We have almost 1.5 million plant remains from the site. The seasonal availability of which is most intense between, say, late August and early November. And during that span of time, or prior to and after that span of time, we don't have any indicators that they were on site at all. So all the evidence we have, both plant and animal, indicates seasonal occupation for brief moments in time.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is James Adovasio, Director of Archaeology at the Meadowcroft Rock Shelter and Historic Village. So at a site where human habitation could date back 19,000 years, something new is actually happening at the Rock Shelter. At the end of August, sediment samples were collected. Why?
Well, essentially, over the last decade, DNA and the retrieval thereof have become a potentially critical component in archaeological research in both the Old World and the New World. Environmental DNA is the kind of DNA that is left by plants and animals upon an archaeological or other kind of paleontological site, if you will, almost inadvertently. Were you to sweat or excrete on a site, you would leave DNA. Were your body to decompose on a site, you would leave DNA. And so the retrieval of this DNA in sediment has become quite important from several standpoints. First of all, certain kinds of sediment preserve DNA when it's affixed to it. And in both the Old and the New World, studies have shown that it is possible under certain circumstances, particularly in protected sites, caves and rock shelters, as well as permanently frozen sites, to retrieve environmental DNA. Where it is good, it can tell you a lot about not only a human presence, but the kind of plants and animals that lived on the site, independent of other lines of evidence.
From what part of the rock shelter were the samples gathered?
They were gathered from the north-south profile on the eastern margins of the site. And it was that profile, that cross-section that we sampled on both sides, if you will, of the boundary between the last ice age and the current period called the Holocene. And within that time frame, we also sampled late ice age deposits.
Is it too simple to say it was like the deepest part that you could access at this point?
It was, in effect, the deepest extant cross-section of the deposits where we could work, yes.
Will this be the first DNA test performed on the sites or artifacts?
It will be the first time we have attempted to find DNA on sediments. It is possible to retrieve DNA from human remains, of which there are a scant few from this location. It is possible to retrieve DNA from residue on stone tools, but while we have done residue studies, the preservation of residue on stone tools at this location is not particularly good. And so if we get any DNA at all, and this is by no means guaranteed, it will be the first time that any DNA has been retrieved from the site.
What could it tell you? What do you hope it tells you if indeed it's found?
Well, the goals of the research were essentially threefold. One was to just see if there was any DNA of any kind, plant or animal or human. The second was to examine whether or not the transition from essentially a late ice age setting to a modern setting could be detected in the DNA. And third, obviously, was to see where in the sequence of events humans might have interjected themselves in the accumulation of environmental residue.
When do you expect to have the results?
We will begin to get answers from the laboratory in Denmark sometime in October as to whether there's any DNA present or not. And then the sequencing of that DNA and matching it to particular plants, animals, or humans will take another several months after that.
Could the DNA sampling help put to rest any concerns by some in the scientific community who still hold fast to a different narrative about when and how people came to the Americas?
Well, as you're probably aware, up until the discoveries at Meadowcroft, Monteverde in Chile, and then a series of other sites, the received wisdom, the conventional consensus in the scholarly community was that sometime about 14,000 years ago, a small group crossed the Bering Straits on foot, pass down between the Cordilleran and the Laurentian ice sheets down essentially the drainage of the Mackenzie River, wound up on the east side of the Rockies, and thereafter spread both east and west and south, their iconic tool was a particular kind of projectile point called, after a site in New Mexico, a Clovis point.
Right.
And so the theory was called Clovis first, meaning the people that made these points were the first ones here, and they were rapidly moving big game hunters who specialized in the hunting of now extinct fauna. Now, Europeans and South Americans have always been critical of this model, even when most North Americans, U.S. and Canadian archaeologists, loved it. Mm-hmm. When it collapsed as a result of discoveries at some of the places I mentioned, there has been no substitute. We don't know exactly when people got here. We don't know how diverse they were. We know they came from Eastern Asia, but we don't know how many times they came. We know that the languages they spoke were probably related most closely to Northeast Asian languages, but we don't know how many different varieties of that language existed. In other words, we know less now than we thought we knew 20 years ago.
You've been studying the Meadowcroft Rock Shelter for four decades. What do you still hope to learn about it?
I think what we've hoped to be able to do is to incorporate new ways of looking at the past so we can answer or try to answer new questions about the past. And if that's the perspective to which you approach any archaeological site, you never stop learning. It becomes a learning experience each and every day. And what you thought you might have known may be erroneous, it may be modified, it may be enhanced, but in any case, it's going to be different than what you thought yesterday.
James Adovasio is the Director of Archaeology at the Meadowcroft Rock Shelter and Historic Village. Thanks so much and good luck.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thank you very much.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. More than 20 states have made a tentative deal with Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family, potentially settling thousands of opioid cases. But Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro calls the settlement a slap in the face. And Pittsburgh has been designated a United Nations Center of Excellence on High-Performance Buildings. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
Is it hot in here? Nah, it's just a few burning embers left over from the famed Hot In Here streaming party of 2016. St. Louis rapper Nelly owed a few million dollars in back taxes, and while he was trying to work it all out legally, his fans picked up the slack and tried to stream Nelly back into financial well-being. As of this airing, Hot In Here has 173,800,540 streams on Spotify, and with a royalty rate of 0.007 cents per stream, old Nelly still fell short. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
Amid the controversy around the Trump administration's new rules, which would weaken the Endangered Species Act, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed taking a rare plant off the endangered species list because it's made a comeback. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. Running buffalo clover is found in our region, and West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Glynis Board went into the woods with some experts to learn more about it.
It's a plant we all know and love, or we think we do, the clover. But one species of clover was thought to be extinct until someone found it in West Virginia 30 years ago. Biologist Rodney Bartkus recalls his discovery was met with some skepticism.
We were walking along the trail, and I told Cloyce, hey, there's running buffalo clover. And he said, no, it's extinct. And I said, Cloyce, that's it. And he bet me a steak dinner that that was not running buffalo clover. And I got that steak dinner.
After Bartkus reported the find, running buffalo clover was moved onto the endangered species list. Today he's hiking with Melissa Thomas Van Gundy, a research forester with the Forest Service stationed here at the Furneaux Experimental Forest in West Virginia. It's one place where you can find the clover.
Part of the running part comes from these plant parts that are like a strawberry runner.
For years, Thomas Van Gundy has been helping to manage the populations of running buffalo clover found here.
Of course, it's not blooming right now, but that is a really good way to identify it.
These clover are not like the ones you find in your yard. They can't tolerate full sun, full shade, or severe disturbance. That said, Thomas Van Gundy explains they love heavy machinery. In this particular tract of land, forest managers use heavy machinery every 10 years or so on paths they call skid roads.
When we first found this, we said, okay, well, Fish and Wildlife Service says, you guys, we can't disturb those plants. Put your skid road up there. Don't use this skid road. Okay, we did that, came back in. Plant numbers had dropped where we hadn't run over them. They showed up on the new skid road.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service listed the clover as endangered in 1987. Since then, more populations have been found and monitored. Today, about 150 populations are known to exist in six states. Many of these populations are on public lands or they're on private land with conservation agreements. Thomas Van Gundy and Bartkus say protecting these rare plants is an important part of maintaining the protective benefits of biodiversity. They say a more diverse forest is more resilient to disease, pointing out that humans ultimately depend on healthy ecosystems for clean air and water. But Bartkus says his motivation to protect the running buffalo clover is also rooted in the value of the stories it tells.
Just imagine standing right here and a herd of mastodon comes through. We know that that happened fairly routinely. That's what this, that's the disturbance making that most of these species evolved in. So, you know, once the mastodons and things like that died out, they relied upon, you know, the buffalo and the elk. So we can go back to that story. And now they rely on us.
When asked if he thought delisting the clover was a good idea, Bartkus said he felt all right about it. But the running buffalo clover isn't quite out of the woods, so to speak. Bartkus pointed to stiltgrass and other invasives that could displace more delicate native species. So it's important, he adds, to continue to keep an eye and maybe a reintroduced elk hoof on them. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Glynis Board.
There are more stories about conservation and wildlife at alleghenyfront.org/wildpa. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. More than 20 states and lawyers representing a couple thousand municipalities, counties, various plaintiffs have reached a settlement with Purdue Pharma, the maker of the painkiller OxyContin, and the owners of the company, the Sackler family. Joining us now on the line from Harrisburg is Pennsylvania's Attorney General Josh Shapiro. Welcome back to the Confluence, sir.
Great to be back with you. Thank you.
After word of the deal got out, you issued a statement calling it, quote, a slap in the face and, quote, I won't let them get away with the harm they inflicted on our Commonwealth, end quote. So what are you doing?
Well, look, I've been at the table leading a multi-state investigation of Purdue Pharmaceutical, along with five other manufacturers and the three distributors of opioids. I think Purdue's conduct is just so egregious. And word of this, I think it is a proposal that's floating around. And it is a proposal. It is a complete and utter slap in the face to Pennsylvanians, anyone who's had to bury a loved one, anyone who's had to deal with drug and alcohol treatment for someone suffering the disease of addiction because they got hooked on these painkillers like OxyContin in the first place, knows that, you know, taking pennies on the dollar from these billionaires, the Sackler family, and by the way, not taking any of their ill-gotten gains, but rather taking money of the proceeds of sales of opioids and sales of overseas companies selling opioids, is really not the answer. And so I'm willing to stay at the table with them as long as they're acting in good faith. But what has become clear is that they are not acting in good faith. And that's why I've made it clear that not only have I sued Purdue, which I did a few months ago, but that I was going to sue the Sacklers personally for their conduct. And I did that this morning.
And as you mentioned, this is a new suit in addition to the one that you filed against the company in May. Full details of this tentative proposal, as you call it, floating around, have not been released. But what we've been hearing is that includes the company filing for bankruptcy, a new company formed to continue selling OxyContin and other drugs, with profits going to pay the plaintiffs and drugs donated for addiction treatment. If those are accurate details, why is that not satisfactory?
Well, understand the deal has been valued, according to some media outlets, I'm not ascribing this to you, at a $12 billion deal. That's a joke. And I've been around the table. I know these numbers. That is not real. A huge component of this deal is one of the Sacklers, the family that owns and operates Purdue and was involved in this, said that they would put up $3 billion. But understand, that's not money that they've reaped from their profits of selling OxyContin. That's money they'll get from selling one of their companies. I want to reach into the pockets of these sanctimonious billionaires and pull some money out and return it to the people of Pennsylvania who have been so harmed.
The proposal apparently includes no admission of wrongdoing. Is that important to you?
Of course. You have to have transparency. You have to have an acknowledgement of the conduct that was wrong. We believe, and we've alleged this in both our complaint against Purdue and the Sackler family, that they had a well-orchestrated effort to specifically target Pennsylvania with these opioids, with the OxyContin, and specifically to target our veterans and specifically to target our seniors and get them hooked on these pills, and then to lie about the addictive nature of it and to lie about the medical research behind it. That is not only wrong and unethical, it's unlawful, and we're going to hold them accountable. And, you know, I'm just unwilling to accept pennies on the dollar and allow these billionaires to walk away with their ill-gotten gains.
Any agreement would still have to be approved by the company's board of directors and by a bankruptcy judge. Do you think a judge would approve any deal when a majority of states, including Pennsylvania, have sort of rejected it?
I don't know. I've obviously been dealing with the judge who's leading the effort in Cleveland, and obviously have talked extensively to counsel for both the Sacklers and Purdue. We've been at the table. I can tell you, I don't know what they'll do. The idea that Purdue would try to settle with less than half of the states, with more than half of states, including big states like Pennsylvania and New York, for example, not being on board with this, seems to me to be an ill-advised approach to addressing this crisis. I also want to just make sure everybody listening understands this is one of six manufacturers. We are still engaged in ongoing investigation and dialogue with the other five manufacturers, and we've had robust negotiations and discussions with the distributors. So while Purdue's gotten so much attention in the media because of their unlawful conduct, they've really become the poster children, if you will, for this crisis. Make no mistake, I'm fighting to hold every single one of these companies accountable.
In speaking with an attorney not associated with this case, he says it's not easy to successfully sue the owners of a company, that you have to show that the owners transferred money out of the corporation to themselves to avoid corporate liability. Is that the case?
I think you, when you have the opportunity to read our complaint, which by legal order is under seal for a brief period of time. Unfortunately, that's not my doing. I wish I could release it today, but that is the process we have to go through. When you read that report, more than 100 pages, you will see how we painstakingly documented the unlawful conduct of the Sacklers and why they need to pay up. Mm-hmm. And the Attorney General's office doesn't take a penny out of this. I want 100% of that money going to the people of Pennsylvania, and I'm going to fight like hell to make sure I can deliver for those people in need, to hold the Sacklers accountable, to hold Purdue accountable. I'm not interested in getting a quick payday, as some of these lawyers are. Not all of them, but some of them. I'm interested in really delivering for the people of Pennsylvania.
Is a settlement that is satisfactory to you still possible, and what would that entail?
I'm not going to get into what is satisfactory and what is not in the context. You know, we're obviously having confidential communication. What I can tell you is what's on the table now is unsatisfactory to me in a majority of states.
You use the term conspiracy. Is there a potential for criminal charges at some point down the line?
I can't comment on that, but I can tell you that we're going to do everything in our power in the Office of the Pennsylvania Attorney General to hold Purdue, the Sackler family who control Purdue, and all of the opioid manufacturers and distributors accountable to the fullest extent of the law.
That's Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro. Thanks so much for taking the time, sir.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh has become only the fourth region in the world to be a UN Center for Excellence because of its collective commitment to building sustainability. Scott Foster is the United Nations Director of Sustainable Energy. He's in Pittsburgh this week to bestow that honor. Welcome to Pittsburgh and to The Confluence, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also in studio is Jenna Kramer, Executive Director of the Green Building Alliance. Jenna, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
Scott, only the fourth region in the world to receive this designation. What makes for a UN Center for Excellence?
We are actually working on a number of initiatives for centers around the world, so you are the fourth, and congratulations. These centers of excellence have a number of requirements. They've got to be really committed to what we're trying to achieve with high-performance buildings. Mm-hmm. They've got to have the local political support for what they're trying to achieve. They've got to have the capacity for actually doing the training and dissemination. So when we look at Pittsburgh, you've got it all. So we're glad to be here.
And Jenna, your reaction?
So this is a very exciting time for Green Building Alliance. We've been working for 26 years to advance and move green building throughout the region. And now we're at a point in time where we're thinking about what's next and how we can do more and better. And so establishing an international center here throughout the region seems like the perfect next step for all of our stakeholders.
Jen, on a local level, what does it mean to be sustainable?
What does it mean to be sustainable? Well, there are three components that we always look at. We are always looking at the environmental impact of our actions, but also the social impact, as well as how it impacts our economics.
So you're on the inside. How would you rate Pittsburgh's progress from that inside?
From the inside, I think that we are in a place where we need to celebrate where we've come as a region. Years ago, we put sustainability at the forefront of our revitalization efforts. We've made a lot of progress in many different ways. We are a leader in green buildings. We have many different sustainability initiatives that are evidenced by some of the biggest companies in the region through our community efforts, through schools. But we all collectively recognize that we still have a ways to go to make it a truly healthy, sustainable, and resilient region for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Scott, do you agree with Jenna's definition of sustainability? Is it different globally?
Actually, it can differ from country to country, from place to place. There are lots of people who think of sustainability in terms of climate change. We're on a trajectory to go to 4 to 6 degrees increase in temperatures. The wacko weather you see outside is associated with 1 degree. So we got a tsunami coming our way, which is not good. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of other folks. They're worried about putting food on their table, a roof over their heads, educating their kids. So how you define sustainability depends on your context. Mm-hmm. The one thing I can say about this initiative that we're working on, the High Performance Buildings Initiative, is probably the one agenda item that delivers across the whole spectrum. It is climate, it is jobs, it is innovation, it is quality of life. So it's a fantastic initiative in our view.
So are there priorities, therefore, within that big concept of sustainability?
There are priorities.
From country to country, I should say.
Well, there are. The countries have to take their trade-offs. Every country's got its own resources, its own background of legislation, regulatory, and culture. So there's not going to be one single path that takes you to the future, but we have to get that collective outcome. Mm-hmm. So the advantage of using a UN platform for this work is actually the ability to go at scale. We can have a global impact. But if you depend on the UN to have another conference, frankly, who cares? What you need are people, local communities, who are actually committed and engaged in the process to deliver the results. That's why working with the Green Building Alliance is absolutely ideal for us.
Mm-hmm. Jenna, Green Building Alliance. But how does that building alliance fit into the overall sustainability within the region, would you say?
Sure. One of the words that we love to focus on, building as a verb, too, that we are regularly and actively trying to advance sustainability through our buildings, through our communities, and through our cities, but also the word alliance. And I think one of the strongest points of this center is it's based in partnerships. And so this work, although we are convening this effort, it's a true public-private partnership across a diverse sector stakeholder group. And so government, business, nonprofits, utilities, many people to make this happen.
I'd like to come in on that, if I may. I get often asked, why did you choose Pittsburgh?
Right.
That's actually not what happened. Pittsburgh's really chosen itself for exactly the reasons that Jenna's laid out. You've got a strong community of professionals. You've got this whole fabric of political support going on. You've got the history of achievement of the Global Green Building Alliance. All of the essential elements are there. Pittsburgh did choose itself.
Mm-hmm. So how important is this collaboration? Who else needs to come to the table, if you would?
You've got a not only bring architects to the table, it's the electricians, it's the plumbers, it's the whole community that's involved in delivering on buildings. Think about how much time you spend in your day in a building. It's all of the users of buildings. This matters pretty much to everybody. Buildings are responsible for 40% of carbon dioxide emissions just because of the energy services that they require. If you put in place the programs that we're trying to pursue, you can address that so we can improve quality of life and deal with climate change. And that's the kind of integrated approach that we seek.
Our guests on The Confluence are Scott Foster, Director of Sustainable Energy with the United Nations, and Jenna Kramer, Executive Director of the Green Building Alliance. So how does that UN designation come about? Do you sort of just keep an eye on the region, say, hey, they're doing some good stuff there, or does a region apply for this designation?
There is globally a very strong network, a community of professionals who are out there. We've actually been in discussions with the Europeans, with the North Americans, other parts of our region. We have established certain criteria. If you're going to be an international center of excellence, you've got to meet these minimum criteria. GBA does so. So do the Building Energy Exchange in New York. We've got one in Ireland. We've got another one coming along in Vancouver. As we've pushed this program forward, there are more and more players out there who want to join this club, join this network, which we, of course, encourage. Just because you want to join doesn't mean you come in the door. Either you're already qualified and you can get involved. Benefits for Pittsburgh, benefits for the others is sharing experience. What the problem you're facing, I've answered that problem. So we can do that sharing. So the value of a network is growing the community, getting that exchange of knowledge, getting the dissemination and the deployment. Frankly, I don't see a constraint on getting this to be a global initiative. We're moving fast in that direction.
Jenna, what are our problems? Maybe better put, what are our challenges right now?
Our challenges. So we have many as a region. I think one of our program areas through the 2030 district, we're really looking at our existing buildings. And so understanding how, whether it's a business, a school, a government office building, how can we drastically reduce the energy and water consumption of those existing places? But also, how do we set higher standards for buildings that are new construction as well? And we have health aspects that we're addressing. So making sure that these spaces are healthy for people who occupy them, but also our regional air quality issues and other environmental issues.
For people who have heard that term, the 2030 district,
sure.
I believe Pittsburgh has one of, if not the largest 2030 district.
It is the largest 2030 district.
Explain, what does that really mean?
Sure. We have, out of the 2030 districts in the world, our 2030 district comprises 18% of that square footage, and we have over 700 buildings in the region committed to 50% reductions in energy use, water use, and transportation emissions by the year 2030. And that groundwork was laid in 2012, and it shows leadership from our business community, our government community, our school community to really adopt these efforts, and it also helps lay a very strong foundation for something like the International Center to be established here, where we're bringing solutions to the table for implementation to achieve those goals.
And the progress right now? Oh,
I was going to come in on that because we went and visited some homes in Ireland where they'd been built to the standards that we're talking about. It's low-income housing. It's social housing in Ireland. And we interviewed the occupants, and all of them were just delighted with what they had. Their home bills were lower. They didn't have any draftiness. There was consistent temperatures in the homes. Their kid no longer was sick because the mold issue was resolved. Their budgets were in balance. That was all fantastic. As a result of all of the people on the waiting list for social housing, they're calling up the central authorities and saying, move us down on the list. We want one of those cool houses. We don't want these standards. So this is not simply the UN coming and saying, doing it like this. It's demand. People want it.
Right. And so Scott talks about housing in Ireland. Jenna, what about challenges of our old housing stock in this city?
We do have a lot of challenges with our old housing stock, and whether those are single family homes or even multifamily homes. And that is part of this effort, too, again, through partnerships to make sure that our homes are affordable, that they're healthy, that they're sustainable. And really, at the end of the day, they are improving the quality of life for people who live there.
Scott, you've been in Pittsburgh a couple times now, I believe. What are the lessons that Pittsburgh can learn from other places that you've visited, whether it's cities, nations?
Well, what I find very intriguing about the network we've put in place is they're doing various types of trainings. So you'll find the people in Vancouver. They're training their permitting people and their code people on how to get the policy framework right. You go to Ireland and they come in and bring the professionals to how do you put duct tape on in the right way? How do you maintain the envelope around a building so it's done properly? You go to New York City, and you've got all of these large-scale buildings. How do you do a big building from an energy efficiency perspective? No two places are going to be alike. They're all different. But suddenly, the problem I had is one that you're facing. I can help you out. And you find that again and again.
Jenna, do you sort of explore what other cities are doing so they could be those ideas could be adapted here?
Yes, we are always benchmarking ourselves against other cities and trying to learn from best practices. And I think that that's one of the greatest opportunities of this effort. And many of our partners around the table, whether it's the city of Pittsburgh, Allegheny County, even Allegheny Conference, I believe they're also looking for best examples to make sure that we're creating a region for everyone and continue to grow in a way where sustainability is centered in our efforts.
Yeah, we often point to two living building challenge recipients, the Frick Environmental Center and the Phipps Center for Sustainable Landscapes, but it's more than just a building or two. It's a policy. What is it, Scott?
What I find in this high-performance buildings initiative, it's dealing with buildings as a complex system, but it's embedded in a community and in a city. And if we're connecting the dots between the different parts of that, it's a better outcome.
Okay. In our last minute, what are our next steps that are short-term attainable?
Short-term attainable, this center really is about implementation and solutions and putting those solutions into action immediately. And we're building partnerships. It's not just about Allegheny County, but also the surrounding areas. And so we are actively engaging with those partners to figure out what our strategies and implementation is in these different areas.
Scott, in a sentence or two, what can Pittsburgh do that's truly attainable in the short term?
What I really find attractive in Pittsburgh is the fact that it's a regional footprint. It's not just within the city of Pittsburgh. What you can do in the near term is actually making sure that you're delivering the capacity and the capability across the entire professional community to do buildings right. You've demonstrated it already. That can be extended.
Scott Foster is the United Nations Director of Sustainable Energy. Jenna Kramer is Executive Director of the Green Building Alliance. This evening, Pittsburgh will be officially designated as the fourth region of the world to be a UN Center for Excellence. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, how should our government leaders and our community support family caregivers? We'll visit with Nancy Murray of Achieva. She's been named as co-chair of the National Family Caregiving Advisory Council. If you missed anything from today's program or you would like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.